Hi guys, glad to be back here with all of you, for those of you in the room, those of you on the radio. It's always wonderful to see my friends, so to speak. So yeah, very nice. Been a nice morning of sharing. I've appreciated that too. And I will continue on with my sharing. It's called No Fluff because I am reading from Michael Langford's book called Experience Your Perfect Soul. And one of the reasons I so love his work is because it feels like there's no fluff to it. It's straight, clear, unadorned sharing. And no, I am not still in Hawaii. I got home late Friday night, but I was listening from Hawaii when I could. So, and one of the things that I will start off by saying right away is sometimes Michael Langford listens to this recording. I don't know that he listens every single time during the time that I share. And as a matter of fact, I know that he doesn't, because he had written me a note quite a while back saying that oftentimes during my sharing time, he is not able to listen due to other things going on. But at some point, if he in fact does hear this recording, he can let me know whether or not my intuition is on point or not. But what I'm going to say is that when I was listening to Michael Langford study group from last week's sharing, I listened to the recording. And Regina was reading a note from Michael about some reading instructions that he was suggesting to those that were reading from another book, The Purpose of Practice and Effort. And one of the things that Michael suggested was that the reader, which in this case would be me, or in that case would be Jay or Regina or whoever chooses to read, does not have to verbally communicate when the book itself is emphasizing a couple of words, a word, a paragraph, or whatever. Because oftentimes, at least for me, it's felt that way for me too, it feels like you're breaking up the thought stream by telling somebody that, for instance, you know, the word faith is in italics, or the word faith is bolded, or the word faith is being stressed. It kind of places your attention on that rather than the message that's being shared. And I've often felt that as the conveyor of the words that I'm reading. And so I am going to take that suggestion myself. I'm not going to be sharing with you, for instance, like, you know, this is in quotes, or this is in italics, or this is separated by a hyphen, or any of that. It felt distracting for me in my own reading. The other thing I will say is that oftentimes when there is a really long sentence, and I've had that experience myself just reading from Experience Your Perfect Soul, just as recently as three weeks ago from Catherine Piedrick, there was one particular sentence that took up about 11 lines in the book. And sometimes as the reader, when you're sharing that, it's like, holy moly, holy moly, if people can't actually see it on a piece of paper or in the book, it can often feel like, you know, what just happened there, what was just said there. And so for me, what is helpful is that I read it many times. And so I probably will be doing that too, reading something like that many times, because it helps me with my own clarity, and just letting you know that ahead of time. And so if Michael wants to respond to me on that and say that that will be more helpful, I would appreciate that. But that's the way I intend to do it from today forward. I felt it was a really good suggestion that he made to the Michael Langford study group reading, and I am going to take that into this particular sharing of Experience Your Perfect Soul. Okay, now that that has been said, I will, you know, put the business part of it aside and begin on page 110, if you have the book, Experience Your Perfect Soul. And we are in the section from Catherine Piedrick, which is chapter 4. And the following quotes by Catherine Piedrick are from the book, The Practical Mystic, How to Make Perfection Appear. And Reverend Gibson was laughing about somebody referring to her as a mystic. And this particular section is called The Unfolding of the Mystic Consciousness. And it's on page 110. After reading and analyzing these mystical experiences, and the mystical experiences that are being referred to, in case we've forgotten, because I haven't been here for a week, were shared in my last time of reading, and that was the mystical experiences of St. John of the Cross, J. Trevor, St. Ignatius, and that's the ones that I see, at least just in a quick glance. So after reading and analyzing these mystical experiences, one may be satisfied with coming to the scholarly conclusions that such states open out other orders of truth to us, and their existence absolutely overthrows the pretension of non-mystical states to be the sole and ultimate dictators of what we may believe. No one could put such conclusions in a more convincing form, Professor James, when he says, our normal waking consciousness is but one special type of consciousness, whilst all about it, parted from it by the filmiest of screens. I almost thought it said flimsiest, like a flimsy screen, because that the image of the veil, A Course in Miracles talks about the veil, that where we drop the veil when we close our mind, when we place our attention external to ourself. But this is, to me, this is speaking to the same idea. So I'll start at the quote again. Professor James is quoting, he's saying, our normal waking consciousness is but one special type of consciousness, whilst all about it, parted from it by the filmiest of screens, there lie potential forms of consciousness entirely different. And to me, that speaks of going beyond the veil, where we decide to place our attention with awareness, pure awareness that is in the silence, in the rest, accepting of everything exactly as it is. We may go through life without suspecting their existence, these other potential forms of consciousness that is being spoken about. So we may go through life without suspecting their existence, but apply the requisite stimulus, and at a touch, they are there in all their completeness. Definite types of mentality, which probably somewhere have their field of application and adaptation. So again, to me, the adaptation portion of it and the application portion of it speak to the human, you know, the self that I still believe that I am, the personal self. But yet this is being spoken of where we can be in this consciousness, this potential form of consciousness that seems entirely different than the consciousness that maybe mostly is unconsciousness, where we're not really engaged at all within, but we're engaged externally using consciousness, but sometimes not even aware that we're using consciousness. And when we become more aware that we are that consciousness itself and not any of the external objects, persons, experiences, things, distractions, detours, we're not any of that piece of it. Yet we are, as human beings, graced from our attention on this entirely different potential form of consciousness that can be accessed and applied and used in an adaptive sense through the human being, right where we are right now as we find ourselves. Nothing has to change except our attention on pure consciousness. And from there, we rest in that silence, in allowance, doing nothing, waiting to be prompted. And alerted me that my battery was low and about to go out. And so, I had to close it out and switch devices. Can you guys hear me now? Thank you. Okay, right back to where we were. We may go through life without suspecting their existence, but apply the requisite stimulus, and at a touch, they are there in all their completeness. Definite types of mentality, which probably somewhere have their field of application and adaptation. Another may go even farther upon the hearing of mystical experiences, and with a worthy ambition to enlarge his horizon, may consciously decide, as a matter of education, to try to enter into such experiences, since this mystical truth exists for him who enters this higher state of consciousness, and for him alone. If, however, one reads the experiences of the mystic, not with idle nor yet intellectual curiosity, but in the light of some definite, finite experience through which he has just passed, his attitude is of a much more serious nature. His experience may be one of sorrow, loneliness, or pain, perhaps one of sin. Or it may be only that his heart beats low and fails of its desire. But whatever the experience may be, if he is conscious of its significance, the weight of it will be sufficient to make him rebel against the actual and long for that which shall transcend it. Must he be finite and subject to a finite order is the question which will persistently force itself upon him. The mystic experiences, read at such a moment, do more than appeal to that faculty which collects data. Do more than kindle the imagination. Do more than arouse our instinct for self-enlargement. And I'm going to pause right there because, you know, this is speaking to that full-blown tendency that the ego has to take over the sharing of a mystical experience in the form of a story, which can be helpful if it's not directed from the egotistical ego that wants to enlarge itself in a spiritual sense by, you know, that grandiosity, bragging, pointing out the importance of this experience that I have, but you haven't. You know, the ego can use everything, including the wonderfulness of a mystical experience, and distort it into a weapon of separation. Yeah, arousing our instinct for self-enlargement, you know, does consciousness need expansion? Does my true self need anything? Need even a mystical experience? While it can be helpful and useful and used by a human being for purposes of waking up, it's probably wise to be cautious of the pitfall that can occur when grandiosity enters the picture. Okay, so again, the mystic experiences, read at such a moment, do more than appeal to that faculty which collects data, the mind, do more than kindle the imagination that's occurring in the mind, do more than arouse our instinct for self-enlargement. They are the ship in sight as we are about to founder. They awaken a hope in us and make a rift in the black cloud which bears down upon us as we eagerly drink in the real significance of the mystical experiences. A Course in Miracles speaks to this as in the miracle principles, where again it tells us, you know, miracles are natural, they're normal, and those words are directed at the self, the capital S self, the truth of myself. In that, resting in that self, miracles are natural. They would not be used to be a spectacle or to attract some form of attention that would reflect grandiosity. They would be used for the good of all. There would be no center stage involved. Yeah. So again, this is telling us, you know, drink in the real significance of the mystical experience. This significance consists in the fact that whereas the so-called rational consciousness is paralleled by a finite world, the highest mystical consciousness is not only paralleled by a divine world, but it and its realm are antagonistic and destructive to the realm of the finite. Those are strong words, you know. The highest mystical consciousness, it's saying, is not only paralleled by a divine world, but it, that highest mystical consciousness, and its realm are antagonistic and destructive to the realm of the finite. And again, we have to take those words. And for me, awareness is not in any sort of battle with or competition with, or it's not doing anything. It allows everything exactly as it is. Yet, because it parallels the divine world where there is only silence, and it reminds me of that song, Heaven is a Place Where Nothing Ever Happens. There's nothing going on, yet because the mind seems to be divided, as we become more familiar with this realm of mystical consciousness that's paralleled by a divine world, a world that is takes its cue from source, that world will at some point come up against resistance to this egoic mindset that says something is trying to destroy me, something is trying to pull the rug out from under my false existence, and I am going to ratchet up my defense systems. I am going to be antagonistic and destructive, and use my quote power to doubt the simplicity of salvation, to doubt that truth can be simple, to use these words antagonistic and destructive, and somehow project that meaning onto awareness itself. And that's how easily we can twist what we read into a meaning it doesn't have. And I'll read that one more time, that sentence, which is, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, almost 6.5 lines long. So again, it says, you know, we're drinking in the significance of the mystical experience. And it says, this significance consists in the fact that whereas the so-called normal rational consciousness is paralleled by a finite world, the highest mystical consciousness is not only paralleled by a divine world, but it and its realm are antagonistic and destructive to the realm of the finite. And just here, we catch a glimpse of the great truth that we ourselves may determine the world in which we live by making a choice of the consciousness which we hold. And there's that, you know, seeming split mind. We're making a choice of the consciousness which we hold. Ultimately, there is only one consciousness. But with the split mind, it seems even in awareness watching, awareness practice, you might find yourself thinking that I'm seeking a consciousness other than the consciousness that feels more familiar, that consciousness that looks out. That very consciousness is the same consciousness you seem to be trying to seek in awareness, watching, awareness practice. There's not two consciousnesses. There's one consciousness. And so there seems to be a choice. I'm going to make the choice to sit down or use the loving all method, whatever method, the loving all method, the loving consciousness method, awareness, watching, awareness, the abandon release method, you know, whatever works for you. And it seems to be a choice. Should we choose to keep active the material human consciousness? Such a choice would assure to us the life of a material being in mind and body, subject to sensuous pleasure, sorrow, sin, pain, death, and all finite conditions. Again, that's choice B, you know, in the most direct means to eternal bliss. For those of us in the gentle healing group, choice B is that choice. Should we choose to keep active the material human consciousness, such a choice would assure to us the life of a material being in mind and body, subject to sensuous pleasure, sorrow, sin, pain, death, and all finite conditions. Should we, however, choose to bring into play and to keep active the highest spiritual consciousness, choice A, we should virtually be determining for ourselves the life of a spiritual being, subject to spiritual law, and free from the physical order with all its attendant evils and pleasures. When once intense suffering or even a lack of joy and interest has revealed to one this real significance of the mystical experience, and he sees through others the potential of his own nature and the possibility of determining to perfection his world, his one desire is to be more awake on the mystic side. And oftentimes in this room, we talk about the motivations we have on our spiritual path and how oftentimes suffering for many people is a huge motivating factor to go the other way. And this is saying the same thing. When once intense suffering or even a lack of joy, you know, just that sense of I'm not experiencing intense suffering in any way, shape, or form. Yet there is this underlying, not quite perfectly happy person. It's like A Course in Miracles has a lesson that says, God's will for me is perfect happiness. It's not just, it doesn't say God's will for me is happiness. It says perfect happiness. It's a very cut and dry, no fluff lesson. So if I'm not experiencing the perfection of God's happiness, which is an eternal happiness, that's how we know it's truth. It's an eternal happiness. It doesn't shift and change and come and go. It's not dependent on circumstances or experiences or someone else doing what I think they should do or me doing what I think I should do. It's not dependent on anything. Anything. And that's what this is saying by a lack of joy, a lack of joy. Joy is an all-pervasive love, an all-pervasive happiness. So when once intense suffering or even a lack of joy and interest has revealed to one this real significance of the mystical experience, and he sees through others the potential of his own nature and the possibility of determining to perfection his world, his one desire is to be more awake on the mystic side. And that I would venture to say is what each of us is here for, that desire to be more awake on the mystical side. And not on the material side, the active human consciousness material side. We are instead moving to the potential of our very nature, the possibility of the perfection of that divine world that is paralleled by infinity, not finite, not a finite state, but infinity. And the more those mystical experiences occur in whatever way, shape, or form they happen to arise for each of us, that desire increases. Michael Langford calls that the intense desire for liberation. If one has become a mystic to the extent of overcoming all the usual barriers between the individual and the absolute, and has become aware of that oneness, that unity between man and God, then all can be mystics and reap all the truths which such states of mind yield. Having established the existence of the mystical consciousness and our obligation to cultivate it, it now devolves upon us to find a method of training the mystical power inherent within us. It now devolves upon us. And I looked that word up the last time I read this book. And devolves means entrusts. So having established the existence of the mystical consciousness and our obligation to cultivate it, it now entrusts upon us to find a method of training the mystical power inherent within us. So to me, that simply speaks to, you know, for instance, in Michael Langford's instructions for awareness, watching awareness practice, we can listen from A to Z, a list of meditation instructions that Karen Wirth so beautifully has recorded as a gift for all of us. And we're asked to use those, one a day. And then you can note in the mind which of those appeals to you in a heartfelt way, and use those that open the heart the most in a repetitive sort of a way. You know, use that one for a month. Use the one that opened your heart and use it for a month. And I'm just now going through the second series of using those meditations because while I used them the first time, I would often use the same one. If it opened my heart, I would use it sometimes 3 or 4 days in a row. And so it took me quite a while to go through A through Z. But I did want to explore all of those. And so to me, this is speaking to the same thing. Find a method of training that cultivates that mystical consciousness, that opens us up even further, and stay with that until intuitively we feel to move on. Before entering, however, upon the training of that faculty which makes for mystical experiences, let us further fortify ourselves against discouragement by realizing again that we neither must nor can enter into the higher religious state of consciousness by means of the finite intellect. And I'm going to read that again. Before entering, however, upon the training of that faculty which makes for mystical experiences, let us further fortify ourselves against discouragement by realizing again that we neither must nor can enter into the higher religious state of consciousness by means of the finite intellect. The mystic himself is aware of this fact. He knows that there is a mental state beyond the finite reason, and that only while he is in this state will the knowledge beyond the finite come to him. So important. Yeah. We therefore see that whatever methods we adopt for the unfolding of our truth-knowing power, such methods will not be directed toward a finite intellect, but will be concentrated upon a spiritual capacity, since it alone can experience spiritual, that is, truth-knowing, states of consciousness. Yeah. So again, in that resting in the spiritual capacity, that resting in the silence without words, that trusting beyond the finite reason, which is not reason at all. from that unreasonable position, the state of consciousness that it's speaking of here, which is the unfoldment of our truth knowing, cannot occur. That, you know, what did it call it? Filmiest? the filmiest, or that film, that veil, has been dropped. It's impossible to experience that, you know, mystical consciousness in a ongoing manner, in an ongoing manner, if the mind is divided, seemingly between two states of consciousness that are actually only one, but because my attention has been placed seemingly in two separate places, sometimes very rapidly, shifting back and forth, right reason is intermingled with wrong reason. And neither one of those types of reasoning are from this truth-knowing power, which unfolds when I give up the idea of right reason, wrong reason. Any state of, you know, duality thinking. Any state of consciousness that, you know, feels already familiar. There's a section back in A Course in Miracles in the manual for teachers, and I can't tell you exactly where it is or exactly what it says, but it's in reference to receiving guidance or listening to the voice within, to intuition. And it says, you know, kind of like when people ask, well, how will I know? And it says, you will know because the mystical experience, I'll use those words because that's what we're reading from in Experience Your Perfect Soul, will be beyond anything that you presently think you know. It will be beyond any idea that you might have had about, you know, even if you're asking the question, you know, what is it I am to say? Where am I to go? What am I to do now? What would you have me see that I am not seeing? What perspective would you give me that I cannot see? When we ask those self-inquiry questions, what am I? Any type of self-inquiry question, the response that is beyond right reason and wrong reason that will be given will feel as if it is from beyond. It will feel unfamiliar, not something that I already seem to know. That's all I can really say about that. It will be new. It will be new. And there will be, you know, at least in my experience, that visceral, I don't know, it's just like an all-encompassing confirmation that it did not come from the thinking mind. So again, we therefore see that whatever methods we adopt for the unfolding of our truth-knowing power, such methods will not be direct toward a finite intellect, but will be concentrated upon a spiritual capacity, since it alone can experience spiritual, that is, truth-knowing, states of consciousness. The unfolding of any power is brought about through its use. To this rule, the capacity in question offers no exception. And since, in its ultimate analysis, our spiritual power to know is a capacity for knowing the truth, Such power will be exercised and so unfolded in proportion to our seeking for and absorption in truth or reality. And I'm going to read that again. The unfolding of any power is brought about through its use. Tooth's rule, the capacity in question, offers no exception. And since, in its ultimate analysis, our spiritual power to know is a capacity for knowing the truth, such power will be exercised and so unfolded in proportion to our seeking for and absorption in truth or reality. Our need is not so much for the unconscious mystic as for one who is conscious of the laws which are operating to bring about his results. Again, conscious of the laws which are operating to bring about his results. And the laws, you know, to me, the laws that it's speaking about are the laws of God, not the laws of man, the laws of God. And our need has been met. The laws of thought operating in our old faiths, and which will be operative in our future understandings, have been discovered. And we may lay hold of these laws. This is the joy reserved for those who seek for the understanding of the truth. The first step to be taken by those who find it necessary to resort to the technique of spiritual mysticism is the comprehension of the general doctrine of idealism. The general doctrine of idealism. The finite sense is the source of the finite. It is the thoughts of the finite sense that present to us the physical world in which we seem to live. This finite sense corresponds to the green goggles which makes the world look green to those who wear them. As one realizes the significance of this idealism, a door opens in his mind, and he becomes possessed with a growing suspicion that perhaps there really isn't any physical world out there at all. Can it really be true that what we call physical nature, all outside ourselves, is but our own conceit of what we see, and that merely because of the make of the finite sense, we may be deceived in believing that we and others have a physical nature subject to physical laws and a physical environment? And that's a question. Can it really be true? Can it really be true? And it's interesting because this questioning or this growing suspicion this the significance of our idealism, whatever application it seems to, whatever doctrine, general doctrine of idealism that we may have embraced. And an interesting one that I have been kind of following on television is Scientology. There has been a ongoing series on the religion of Scientology, which I was very unfamiliar with, even though it's one of its largest centers is here in Los Angeles, and its main center is in St. Petersburg, Florida. And I've also seen that as well. But to be learning about how Scientology works through one of the defectors or a suppressant person she's now considered to be within the religion, and interviewing various people who have left that religion after the idealism of the religion, the significance of the idealism was shattered, I will say, or there was a sense of delusion that was so strong that longtime members, 30 and 40 year members of Scientology, left the church. And so the deception in all, and I'm not picking on Scientology, I'm simply noticing in one form of this finite sense or this physical world or this particular idealism, we all have an opportunity to question and to truly look at what we're being told, what we've accepted as true, what we've believed. We can look at our thoughts. It has nothing to do with blaming whatever the form might be. That's just the impetus to get us to stop and ask, is this really true? Is what I'm thinking true? Is what I'm believing true? Is what I'm seeing true? Am I subject to physical laws? And while we are certainly encouraged, even in A Course in Miracles, to, you know, Jesus says, I'm not telling you to, you know, just because I say you're not a body, you're free, you're still as I've created you, doesn't mean you stop feeding the body, or, you know, when you get in a car, you know, don't stop at a red light. That's not what I'm speaking of. You know, don't put on your, excuse the language, dumbass hat and turn my words into something they're not. And that's what the ego always wants to do. So we use discernment in the most judicious of ways, but we are turning our attention not to physical laws, not to the physical environment, but within. Again, we go on. It says, unless we have the courage and faith to pass beyond our old landmarks, we shall never be able to enter into that real world in which alone the problems of life find their solution. And the word alone there means it's the only way. It's the only way. No matter how many roads we may turn down or turn towards externally, the only way is enter into the real world, which is within. Again, unless we have the courage and the faith to pass beyond our old landmarks. We shall never be able to enter into that real world in which alone the problems of life find their solution. In spite of all this plausible pleading on the part of the finite intellect or sense, our hearts still long for a reality which by its nature excludes the finite, the physical. Spiritual idealists hear a voice, and it is not the voice of the finite mind. Moreover, this voice is more than a longing. It tells in detail of an order and how to reach it, which is not the physical order and which contradicts its pretense. And there's that reference again, that word contradiction. We can go back, you know, a couple of pages to those antagonistic and destructive words that I stopped to comment on. Let's see. Those words contradict, the antagonistic and destructive words contradict the pretensions that we place on those words, somehow assigning a meaning to those words as if awareness can be antagonistic and destructive. And that's not how that's being shared. But that would be the way physical order would say that those words are being used. And words can be very, very divisive, or they can be very, very inclusive. And it's up to me to take the time to read slowly, to contemplate what's being read, to see the proper application with right reason, until reason is no longer needed and the knowing is right there, readily available. There's no, you know, even stopping to have to contemplate. I simply know, because my mind is resting with truth knowing that only knows. It's the voice, you know, that tells in detail of an order and how to reach it. And it's not the physical order. It's an order that contradicts the physical order's pretensions. So in such hearing, and whoa, I just happened to look at the time. I am out of time. I am so sorry. I was almost finished with that particular section, just a couple of more paragraphs, but I actually lost track of time. So I am going to give up the mic and thank you all for joining me. I appreciate you hanging with me. Go ahead. Rebecca isn't here. Let me just finish this then. Thank you. I will. Thank you. Thanks for letting me know. I've been a little in and out of the room, so I don't really know what's going on. At any rate, back to the reading, because we're almost finished with this section, and I personally would like to finish it as well. So I'm going to go back one paragraph and read it in its entirety and then finish it. So spiritual idealists hear a voice, and it is not the voice of the finite mind. Moreover, this voice is more than a longing. It tells in detail of an order and how to reach, which is not the physical order, and which contradicts its pretensions. In such hearing and seeing, lies our hope of escape from this whole physical and finite order of things. When this divine voice made itself felt only as a longing, we still listened to the voice of the finite mentality and allowed it to dictate so-called laws of belief to us. But the divine voice or consciousness has now spoken in unmistakable terms to the spiritual idealist. He has become aware of the spiritual consciousness as having authority and sees that only as it awakes and unfolds to its fullest shall he come to know those truths which are unplumbed by the finite intellect, which are unknown to finite feelings, and which will save him from both. And, you know, just that idea of being unplumbed, you know, from it's it will no longer be part of my plumbing, this finite intellect, this idea that I think I know. And I've always loved that line from A Course in Miracles that, you know, talks about what you think you think. You know, what you think you know. That intellect that claims some sort of, you know, knowledge to be unplumbed, unplugged from that. You know, reroute the plumbing. And finite feelings, I mean, even just to say finite feelings, that constriction that easily comes up with attention on finite feelings, that, you know, how feelings can feel so strong, so overwhelming, so manipulative in the sense of like a tsunami when an experience occurs or a happening happens or words are spoken or there's a death or there's some sort of occurrence that just kind of rocks your world and is unexpected. Because there's that connection with spiritual consciousness, because we've made a commitment, we've really truly decided, we have a purpose. We wake up with a goal in mind. Today, I will be aware only of awareness. Help me. You know, whatever it is you say, help me to remain consistent in that. Each time we place our attention there first, that authority becomes stronger because we give it that attention. And so we recognize the power it has, which is my power. It's me. It's true self. I'm not disconnected from that. I am that. And not even, you know, in the sense of it being a separate thing. I pay attention to that. Again, we become aware, and this is calling that the spiritual idealist. Still seemingly existing in a world of perception, yet knowing that is not where I want to place my attention. Perception is that selective process that picks out the bits and pieces it wants to see
and sees only that. How blind is that? That's what our lesson today is. Without forgiveness, I will still be blind. Or you could say, without awareness, I will still be blind. If I'm unaware that I'm using awareness to see sin, as the Course said in this particular lesson, sin is the symbol of attack. Sin doesn't show Christ's vision. Sin doesn't let me see my brother's reflection of loveliness as my own, because, of course, I'm busy looking for the fault. I'm busy looking external to myself to see my brother as the sinner. That spiritual idealist. That's the spiritual idealist this is still speaking to. Yet it is reinforcing for us that the divine voice that doesn't speak from that finite mentality, but dictates instead the laws of belief that it has accepted from the get-go, from the moment we learned all words. We didn't come in to this existence as humans knowing all words. We learned every bit of it. Those beliefs, that finite mentality, listening, we've listened to that for a long time, that dictator. And it's simply dictating what we've accepted. We've done it all to ourselves. And now, as we're becoming more spiritually consciousness, this spiritual idealist, we're reinforcing that consciousness that has a different kind of authority. It doesn't, you know, it's not barking orders, seemingly telling me what to do. I'm not listening to that. I might be, you know, cutting that thought off and laughing at it at this point, recognizing, oh, no, you don't. Not again. That spiritual idealist, that's becoming unhooked from, unplumbed from the finite intellect, the finite feelings that go along with that intellect. And we're saved from both of those. That is our salvation, when we refuse to listen. And I'm going to read this paragraph just one more time because I liked it. In such hearing and seeing lies our hope of escape from the whole physical and finite order of things. When this divine voice made itself felt only as a longing, we still listened to the voice of the finite mentality and allowed it to dictate so-called laws of belief to us. But the divine voice or consciousness has now spoken in unmistakable terms to the spiritual idealist. He has become aware of the spiritual consciousness as having authority, and sees that only as it awakes and unfolds to its fullest shall he come to know those truths which are unplumbed by the finite intellect, which are unknown to finite feelings, and which will save him from both. Those of us who entered upon the study of idealism for the sake of ridding ourselves of the finite, may rejoice that so early in our course, we may be led by a type of idealist which denies God's authorship of the finite. This is the first step in the right direction. Let us now follow the way, the thought path, of these mystic or spiritual idealists and make it our own. It is mystical, but not mysterious. And that, my friends, is the end of that particular section, which was quite long. I'm ending on page 118. I started on page 110, and I ended on page 118, and that particular section was called The Unfolding of the Mystic Consciousness. And it really, for me, directly reflects also what Reverend Rebecca shared this morning about becoming aware of that mystic within herself, that small voice. She was describing it as a small voice and coming in bits and spurts, and you know, maybe not having a full blown like. It's not, you know, she's not experiencing it as having conversation with her in sentences and full-blown paragraphs and not like sitting with a friend and jibber-jabbering and talking, but coming in bits and spurts and trusting that. And that's what this is saying to us. You know, we're following a different thought path, one that's coming in maybe fits and spurts, but still trusting that and following that and opening up to that. And as we do, it's like tuning into that channel that becomes stronger and stronger and stronger until that becomes the only channel that we listen to, because it's such a different experience. It's the direct experience of our own divine truth. And it no longer seems like some mysterious other that's something other than me. It's all only me. All of it. Whether I'm making up the story or whether I'm in my right mind or right reason, which is being called the spiritual idealist, or whether I've moved beyond that to resting in awareness, watching awareness all the time. It doesn't matter what seeming stage we seem to be at. We wouldn't be here in this room if we were not interested in being open to growing and fully stepping into the truth. We wouldn't be here. We'd be doing something else. So I just want to thank all of you that are, you know, here with me now. I know sometimes it can feel like tough reading, or, you know, it's not like reading. It's kind of like reading A Course in Miracles for the first time, you know, sort of like, huh? I don't find this reading to be, I love it. I actually love it. So, yeah, I hope you do too. I hope it touches your heart in some way, shape, or form. And it grows on you. So at any rate, thanks guys. I appreciate you sharing this time with me, and I'm going to give up the mic and go on with my day, kind of catching back up after vacation, but I'm glad to be back in the sanctuary, and thanks again. Bye guys, releasing the mic.